issue about having to change their garments, not wearing wool.
Not sweating.
Yeah.
I would think that offering stuff is going to make you sweat.
Well, yeah, but you'll sweat less. They have to wash them, you know, they have to wash.
I know, but I mean, if, when you think about how many sacrifices they may be doing.
Right. Well, I think what he's just saying is he's saying, in general, they're going to be cleaner without wearing wool.
Right.
As opposed, I don't think he's saying they're not going to sweat at all.
Okay.
He's just saying don't wear clothes that
will make
cause
you
sweat.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And
that makes
so,
more sense.
Yeah, there were going to be times, depending on what they're doing and the temperature, where they're going to sweat probably. But part of the idea was that there's this whole issue where he's trying to separate between the clean and the unclean, and the idea that as you approach him, you have to prepare and change your clothes,
right,
and go through washing and all that kind of thing. And so there's an emphasis on them, you know, remaining as clean as possible. And when they go out, they can't wear the garments that they were wearing when they were
sacrificing.
and then it also talks about their hair as well. And part of that has to do with things that people did in mourning. You know, they would shave their head, or they wouldn't cut their hair, you know. So he's just saying in this particular priesthood, he wants them to have, you know, medium-length hair that's trimmed, not shaved heads and not long hair, right? And then he is also saying that when they go into the inner court, they're not supposed to drink wine.
I have a note that says that shaving their head or letting their hair grow long were both signs of mourning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right.
I just
said that.
Oh, sorry. I'm just reading something else.
Well, that's good. I always feel good when the study Bible says the same thing.
Drinking wine because it could miss or slow their thinking.
I think so. I mean, it was the same. There was the same restriction on the high priest in the Old Testament, too, which many Christians try to use to say that, oh, no Christian should ever drink wine, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's basically just saying that serious business, right? It'd be like somebody who's on the beat and a policeman or a fireman or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we can't afford the risk of potentially not being at your peak.
Yeah.
And in this case here, if we go back to the Old Testament, we see situations where when people did things wrong, there was pretty serious consequences, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's just underscoring again this idea that as they approach him, it's a serious matter. And so he's saying, he's outlining wine for them just when they're on duty, so to speak.
A weird place to think about drinking wine anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it kind of depends. I mean,
it's funny you'd have to say that. Don't drink wine when you're...
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, the Bible, there's a lot of passages in the Bible that talk about the blessings of wine and enjoyment of wine, and it's considered a blessing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, you could kind of make the argument if you wanted to that, you know, he talks about the first fruits of all the best goes to the priest, and you could kind of say, well, why not the wine too, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he's recognizing, I think, that even though it's a blessing in general, that it's easy to abuse it.
Mm-hmm.
Too easy to abuse it.
In Leviticus, though, it's even more stringent than that. It says you and your sons are not to drink wine or beer when you enter the tent of meeting, or else you will die.
Mm-hmm.
This is a permanent statute throughout your generations.
Great, yeah, great. Thanks for sharing that. So, here on 21, it doesn't say you'll die, but there's definitely an implication that there's like you could, you know. And if you go back to like your passage you're looking at, so it's like it wasn't a flippant thing to be called as a priest,
right?
So in your, you know, there's just that general principle that you see in Scripture where when the more you know of God, the more responsibility you have. And that's one of the reasons why he is so hard on the Levites when they were not faithful. I mean, a lot of people in Israel weren't faithful, but these ones had greater responsibility because they were the ones that were closest to him.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also the ones that influenced other people. And so it was more of a serious thing. And then he also gives limitations on who they can have as a wife, right?
Mm-hmm.
Verse 22. That's much the same as what you'd see in the Old Testament as well. Well, this is the Old Testament. When I say Old Testament, I guess I'm thinking in the first five books,
mm-hmm.
the Pentateuch or whatever, where the law is, where Israel is given the rules for the Mosaic law in the Solomon's temple. And then he's emphasizing in verse 23 that they're supposed to teach people between holy and unholy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can apply that even to a certain degree. You could apply that to us today. I mean, that's part of the function of the church, is to declare before the culture what's acceptable to God and what's not, right?
Yep.
So, I mean, we don't expect people who are not believers to voluntarily follow God, but part of our role as being lights and salt and light is to say what's right and what's wrong. Just like John the Baptist when he mm-hmm. talked with Herod, right? He lost his head for it, but part of that was over what he had, you know, he was telling Herod things which ended up getting him in jail. And then it goes on in verse 24, I mean, it's just a long list of things. He talks about them judging.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though the king had certain, in the Old Testament or in the earlier part of the Bible, the king had certain influence in making judgments as well. The official judge line of judges was related to the priests, right? Like Moses was the first one pretty much who was judging for Israel at Mount Sinai. And that's because the emphasis on the rules were more, how do you want to call it, they're more oriented, since it was a theocracy essentially, the laws were very oriented toward things that were theological or temple oriented and having to do more with the priests, so the priests were more knowledgeable of the law in general than other people would be. And then in 25 you've got this same restrictions, pretty similar to what you'd see in the rules from the law of Moses as well, that they're not allowed to grieve, you know, except certain exceptions for
only four, yeah.
And so there's that whole issue again where they're supposed to be separated to God, and except for these exceptions, they have to keep in mind that their focus is more toward God than, so that's just one of the things where, you know, people often get this idea that the priests are supposed to minister to the people, but really when you look in the Old Testament, the emphasis is the other way around,
mm-hmm.
that the priests minister to God. Obviously they don't ignore the people, they're doing things that are serving what the people are supposed to do in the temple, but they're not really focusing on the people. So it'd be much like worship leaders or people in worship today, where, like I think you've mentioned before too, Kevin, where even though there's people in the congregation and you're not unaware of them as a worship leader, your focus during worship is on God,
mm-hmm.
and in a sense you're worshiping God and the congregation is worshiping with you,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you're kind of leading the worship Godward. And I think keeping that focus can be really important, because otherwise you can get into a situation where you're overly concerned about, you know, you're looking at the congregation, just like somebody's preaching, whatever, you're overly concerned about the congregation when really you're representing God and focusing more on God. So let's see, what else is there in here? Okay, verse 28 is interesting too, right? They're not allowed to have possessions, mm-hmm. As far as property, what they're talking about mm-hmm. there. And this is the one from Zadok. And there's another theme that has to do with the priests and people that would be really close to God, is this whole idea that they would look to him for their provision and not be caught up in trying to provide for themselves or have their own property and things like that. And what you see is that, you know, in the very next verse, every dedicated thing in Israel shall be theirs, right, in verse 29. So it's basically saying they don't need to try and provide for themselves to work the land, because these offerings that come from the people is what's supposed to support the priesthood, mm-hmm. right? And so even though they don't farm and, you know, have cattle and all that, I mean, when you look at verse 30, the best of all first fruits of any kind in every sacrifice, the best of it mm-hmm. shall be the priests. And by doing that, he says he's going to bless the people. So that when the people obey that arrangement, then God promises that he'll bless the people for that. So there's this issue again where they're close, God allows them to be closest to him, and so they, in a sense, represent him among the people. And but they're also without means of providing for themselves, so they're dependent more on the people to give, and by the people giving, that essentially is a way that the people honor God by supporting mm-hmm. the priests, essentially. What else is there in here? Oh, then it talks about the priests shouldn't eat anything that dies naturally. You know, that's just
probably because the blood still.
Yeah, probably because the blood wasn't
drained
mm-hmm. Right away, or possibly just because it's not clean. Mm-hmm. You know, because same sort of thing. So you can't go out there and eat roadkill if you're a priest.
But most hunters would never eat anything that hasn't been bled, because if you can get something from it, I don't know what it is. But mm-hmm. even my dad, when I was a kid, he always made sure they were bled, just, or they tasted, because I saw a guy do that one time, and the meat tasted weird.
Mm-hmm.
And, no.
Yeah, I'm sure there's health-related benefits mm-hmm. from it as well. You know, there's quite a few of the things in the Old Testament law that had side health benefits. I don't know that you could say they're all motivated by that, because some of the things clearly aren't. They're mm-hmm. pretty arbitrary as far as they're just showing obedience to God. But things like that, I could definitely. So that's kind of a long section at the end of chapter 44. Are there any thoughts or comments about that? Or it's not super exciting. Probably one of the more difficult sections to read through. Just like, you know.
Like you said, it's like reading Leviticus again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you guys want to go into 45?
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and read. I guess I haven't read for a while. So I'm going to try to read the first five verses, I guess. Not too big of a jump. Moreover, when you divide the land by lot into inheritance, you shall set apart a district for the Lord, a holy section of the land. Its length shall be 25,000 cubits, and the width 10,000. It shall be holy throughout its territory all around. Of this there shall be a square plot for the sanctuary, 500 by 500. We're going to have differences in our translation.
Mm-hmm.
500 by 500 broad, mine says.
Mm-hmm.
With 50 cubits around it for an open space. So this is the district you shall measure, 25,000 cubits long and 10,000 wide. It shall be the sanctuary, the most holy place. And it shall be a holy section of land belonging to the priests, the ministers of the sanctuary who come near to minister to the Lord. It shall be a place for their houses and a holy place for the sanctuary. An area 25,000 cubits long and 10,000 wide shall belong to the Levites, the ministers of the temple, and they shall have 20 chambers as a possession. So I did find a diagram of this, or part of it. So it's going to talk about how the tribes get pieces of land. And there's differences of opinion about how far east this border is supposed to go. Some people draw it at the river Euphrates.
Mm-hmm.
Some people bring it down to the Sea of Galilee and down the Jordan to the Dead Sea.
Mm-hmm. But make it natural.
Yeah. But this is what the basic layout, and it's going to be a little bit different than what you see in the previous layout in the times of Moses and thereafter. But here in the center is the strip that goes across, which is describing now that we're looking at. And in particular, just this square section here, which is like kind of like that. So you've got the priest portion where the sanctuary is, and then we're going to see that north of it there's an area where the Levites, mm-hmm. Levites are to live. And then the actual city is south of the sanctuary, and then there's sections of land that are for the city. So this whole kind of layout here is then in this square here, where you'll see that the prince we talked about, that person mm-hmm. called the prince, particular leader, he has sections of land on each side of this central section that we're looking at. So it's, you know, in some ways it's similar to what you find in the earlier books of the Bible, where the land was divided
mm-hmm.
by lot to different
mm-hmm. by the tribes.
But it's a little bit different in that, in this particular layout, as we're going to see as we go along, there's five tribes to the south and seven to the north.
Mm-hmm.
You would kind of expect it to be six and six, but it's not. And some things to notice, which we haven't really got to that yet, but we will in a minute, but is that we have this idea already that the people that are closest to the temple are, that's a place of favor,
mm-hmm.
right? The Levites are favored, but the Zadok ones are favored the most, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then when you look here, you see Benjamin and Judah are the two mm-hmm. tribes on each side. Well, in the Old Testament, or this is the Old Testament. In the early Old Testament.
In the Old Testament.
In the Pentateuch, whatever,
mm-hmm.
You had Benjamin and Judah. Well, okay, so Benjamin and Judah, can anybody think of why they would be grouped together or treated similarly? So those are two of the 12 tribes, right?
Wasn't Judah the oldest?
Benjamin. Yeah, so he wasn't the oldest, but he ended up with the inheritance mm-hmm. because of problems up in before mm-hmm. with Reuben and so forth.
Wasn't
so
Benjamin the favorite?
Hmm?
For Rachel? Joseph. Yeah.
Yeah.
Joseph and Benjamin.
So, but if you think about the tribes,
mm-hmm.
if you think about all the tribes of Israel, what is it that makes Judah and Benjamin associated in the historic picture of Israel? So people talk about the lost 10 tribes, even though they're not lost, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when people say the lost 10 tribes and there's 12 tribes,
mm-hmm.
what does that imply about the division of the tribes?
So they know where Judah's and Benjamin's are, but not the other 10?
Right. So when the tribes were divided, it was divided 10 versus 2.
Mm-hmm.
And so the 2 that are in the two are Judah and Benjamin. So in the Civil War, where Israel's divided into a northern kingdom and a mm-hmm. southern kingdom, right? Mm-hmm. The northern kingdom were the other 10 tribes, and the southern kingdom were Judah and Benjamin. Mm-hmm. So if you look at this from an idea of why would they be favored, I mean, assuming, it doesn't say they're favored, but I'm just saying, looking at this layout, they're closest to God.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm implying, if the Zadok guys get to be closest and they're favored, and the Levites are next, and then these two tribes are next, why would these two tribes potentially have a place of favor over the other 10? Can you think of why they might?
Well, doesn't Christ come from the tribe of Judah?
Okay, so one potential, of course, is that King David mm-hmm. and Christ are in the line of Judah, right? And so David, there's a lot of promises to mm-hmm. David, and that leads to Jesus. But why would Benjamin potentially be in the...
Well, there were two in the southern kingdom.
Okay,
right?
And why would the southern kingdom be favored over the northern kingdom?
Because they're better.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
they were obedient for longer.
The others left.
Right. They all went apostate, but they didn't go apostate as quickly.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, it's not so much, it's like who's the least worst.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Because they all went apostate and they all got overthrown, right? The northern mm-hmm. kingdom was taken by Assyria in judgment in 722 BC. And it wasn't until like 538 or so that the 537 or 8 that the southern kingdom fell to Babylon, or 587. I was thinking the other end of it, 587. So anyway, you've got about 150 years roughly there, or 120 years, whatever. You have a period of time between the two where the southern kingdom is still hasn't gone south as far as fast,
mm-hmm.
but they still go wonkers
mm-hmm.
and God still has to judge them, but in this particular situation God is saying, well, out of the 12, these two I'm going to give a place of favor. And then the other thing to notice,
isn't Paul from the tribe of Benjamin?
Yeah, Paul's from Benjamin, and Saul was as well, right?
So, yeah, which Saul? Not Saul, Paul Saul.
No, the other Saul.
Yeah, Saul.
Okay, so that's...
Yeah, yeah. So, which testament am I in? Right. So King Saul,
the really old one.
King Saul's a Benjamite.
Okay.
Right. And the first king was from the Benjamin line.
Okay.
Which, anyway, so yeah. So, but Paul's had two names, Saul and Paul. Okay, so, but up here in the far, far frozen north,
mm-hmm.
who do we see up there? I guess it's...
What do you see?
Dan.
And
that's Herod.
Because isn't he the weren't they the fighters?
Can I think of this now? So Dan is a tribe that seems to be treated a little differently in certain circumstances. That's Dan means judge, and that's where Samson came from. But in Revelation, it's been a while since we've been in Revelation, right? But in Revelation 7, chapter 7, remember there's 12,000 from each tribe that
mm-hmm.
steal?
Mm-hmm.
Dan's missing.
Yeah.
Right.
From that list. And some people say, well, so what? And other people say, well, I think it's significant. And I'm one of those who thinks it's significant, because I think, well, isn't that interesting? Dan is the furthest away here.
Hmm.
And if we say that being near God is a place of favor, then being the furthest away isn't really much of a favored spot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then you get in the time of Revelation where there's this great persecution of Israel, time of Jacob's trouble, whatever, and you have these particular people from different tribes of Israel that are sealed and protected by God's seal, and the tribe of Dan is not listed there. That doesn't sound good if you're a Danite, right? Mm-hmm. During that time, because it's like, well, wait a minute, where's my protection, right? So when you look at the pattern of the tribe of Dan, you find that it was through Dan that some of the first idolatry was brought into Israel. And there's, if you do a study of the tribe of Dan, there's some negative things there having to do with their lack of, just kind of like the Levites, only, you know, for the other tribes, mm-hmm. their lack of faithfulness and their tendency toward idolatry. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's a whole big rabbit that I'm not prepared to go off on today. But
I forgot it. Oh.
There's this whole issue of is there a relationship between the tribe of Dan and the false prophet or the Antichrist, right?
Oh. Mm-hmm.
But most people, so there's a difference of opinion about that, but many people believe that the false prophet may be Jewish, and that he may be from the tribe of Dan, because of some of the things that there's some little tidbits that are said in prophetic passages that imply negative things about Dan that some people interpret as being connected with what happens in the time of the end, but it's kind of controversial. So.
Herod? Isn't Herod for Dan?
No, I don't think so. He's Idumean, I think. So I don't know. I don't know. I'm not sure he is. I don't think he is. But
mm-hmm. Well, Dan mm-hmm. was Rachel's handmaid.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm. that's where the name came from.
Yeah.
Right.
But it starts back there.
Right. And so, you know, Solomon is a, or not Solomon. If you read, so the book of Kings, 1 and 2 mm-hmm. Kings, right, is, well, okay. So Judges, I guess, is the one I'm thinking of. But in Judges, where it's talking about everyone did what was right in their own eyes. You know, but
right.
if you read the book of Judges, it's a giant disaster, right?
Yeah.
Right from beginning to end, it's just this long, tiresome history of them, God giving them a judge, and then Israel starting to do some good things, and then blowing it. And people, but all the way along the line, it keeps talking about people did what was right in their own eyes. And there's themes running throughout that book that, when you read it, are giving the back of the hand, the back, you know, kind of a, it's there's negatives being said there. Like for example, you have Barak and Deborah in there,
mm-hmm.
right? So Deborah is a judge in Israel,
mm-hmm.
and she's trying to get Barak to go and be a man and do his thing, and he barely gets talked into it by her, and the way it's all put, she we'd have to go there and read it, but she more or less says, well, this Sisera, this guy that we're going to be fighting, he's going to be given into the hand of a woman. That's a back of the hand.
Mm-hmm.
That's a slap,
mm-hmm.
spiritual slap to Barak and toward Israel, because he's saying, because you men won't get up and do what you're supposed to do, women are leading,
mm-hmm.
which, thank God, the women were there to lead, right? But that's part of what that's about. And then when you get to the very end, you've got Samson. Samson is supposed to be a Nazarite from the womb, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things a Nazarite is supposed to do, not touch anything dead.
Right.
Well, what's he getting, honey out of the carcass of an
yeah.
animal? He marries a prostitute from the Philistines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Go find me a wife. Then when he goes and kills these guys with the jawbone of a donkey, he's got a jawbone in his hand.
Mm-hmm.
He's not even supposed to touch anything that's dead. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So the more you study Samson, you know, it's kind of funny because, I mean, there's a sense in which Samson's a picture of Israel, essentially, when you look at it, where he's supposed to be called of God, just like the nation was,
mm-hmm.
and he's constantly violating what he's supposed to do, and yet still God sticks with him for a long time. And then eventually, he just does so much goofy stuff that God allows him to be captured, overcome by a woman, mm-hmm. right? Essentially, mm-hmm. through the guiles of a woman. He gets his eyes taken out, so he's blind. And then he's made to be just kind of a servant until at the end he ends up vindicated. You know, he's killed, but he takes down the temple. So anyway, when you look at this whole book of Judges, Judges relates to Dan. Dan means judge, and Samson is a Danite, right? So there's this whole book of Judges is kind of saying, the people that were supposed to judge Israel just failed and failed and failed and failed, and the climax is Samson at the end of the book. And so there's, when you're done with the book of Judges, if you've been kind of paying attention to the idea of Dan being the judge, you can see there's a big blot and a big failure, big boo-boo mark associated with that. And so that's one of the reasons why people think that Dan's not mentioned in Revelation 7, and also why maybe they're out here at the far north on this layout. I don't know. I'm just saying that when you look at Dan, also like if you go back and look at the camp of Israel around the tabernacle in the wilderness. Remember, the tabernacle was a portable temple, and so they would set it up. And then when it was time to move, they had to take it down, and they had to march in a certain order. And so the tribes camped around this tabernacle from east to south to mm-hmm. west to north. And so when they packed up to leave, the first tribe, and they packed in groups of three. So the first group of tribes to unpack was Judah. Mm-hmm. And praise, why do we have worship before we teach the scripture? Part of it comes from that pattern that Judah leads, that praise goes first, the victory comes after praise. And so the whole issue of like Jericho, where they march mm-hmm. around, and it's when they essentially praise and yell at the end, that's when the walls mm-hmm. fall down. Mm-hmm. And so there's this whole thing that we could go off and look at a whole bunch of passages where the idea is that Judah means praise. And so the idea was that Judah would lead first. But anyway, if you look at how those camps are made and then how they head off, mm-hmm. and you remember that they're all going along in a long list, who do you think, which group do you think is last?
Dan.
Dan. Dan is last. And Dan is on the north side. Mm-hmm. So when they come from, you know, east, over to south, and then to west, and then north would leave last. And so here's Dan way up in the north again, but Dan was last in that whole of the groups of tribes. The group under Dan was the last one. So
there's some significance for when all the people from the north come down, da 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 da, he's going to be one of the first ones hit.
Could be, yeah. I mean, in this particular setting, if it really is the millennial kingdom, it talks about people attacking Israel and Jerusalem from all different directions. But in general, in the Old Testament, for sure, that most often the people that would come against Israel would be Assyria and Babylon, Persia, and they would come from the north. Mm-hmm. Right. And occasionally you have Egypt coming from the south. So either one of the things you point out, which I think is really valid, is that either one that's on the edge is more likely to be attacked first, mm-hmm. and more likely to have to defend if anyone comes against the country, because they have to go through that first. So if you think about a country that's trying to protect its borders, like if say the United States in a time of war, we're more vulnerable, or Alaska, right, or California, mm-hmm. than maybe Minnesota, mm-hmm. right? Because if somebody, of course, nowadays people fly and do all sorts of different things, so it's a lot different. But when people were land armies, they had to go through the perimeter first.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were the strongest when they got to the perimeter. And then after fighting, they would maybe get weaker before they got to the center. So yeah, that's an interesting observation as well. So we don't really know. It doesn't. So a lot of these things that I'm talking about are inferences. They're not outright stated. They're just things that you notice if you look at things over a period of time, you start to see some of these patterns where there's some negatives that are said. So what we're seeing in this little section is this square in the center. And again, when you look at this layout, and you look at the area, and you look at how the tribes are laid out, that's never happened in history.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Right? It's just never been laid out like this. Dan has been in the north in the past, mm-hmm. but the layout of these tribes was never like this. And then the other thing is, so when you get to the situation where people want to say, well, this is just somehow a remembrance of the way things were before, it's not. It's different. And again, if you want to relate the layout of this land to the church in our period of time, what does it mean? You know, what's the square mean? And what's, you know, how do you practically make sense of it as a spiritual lesson other than the general principles? You know, all scripture is written for our learning, right? So I mean, like, part of what I'm trying to say is that don't be someone who's going to be on the north end.
Yeah.
be someone who's going to be close to God. I mean, that's one of the things we can learn from this, is that God favors those who are obedient and love Him and desire to be near Him, and He reveals Himself to those who seek Him, right? And so we see people in the culture who ridicule God and they mock God. You know, like, I saw a presentation at a computer, it was a computer science conference, you know, because I work with computers, and it was about programming, aspects of programming, using certain kinds of methods for programming, team development of software. And the guy who was giving the presentation there was talking about, oh yeah, he says, I moved to Texas, the Bible Belt. And he says, and he related this whole story about how his son, you know, all these kids in his son's school believe in God, and, you know, how naive and silly that was,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so he was all proud about the fact that his son got up on the monkey bars or whatever on some plaything several days in a row during recess and was yelling, you know, God doesn't exist, and if he existed, he'd strike me down. He doesn't exist, and all this kind of stuff. And he was all proud about that,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, showing that these superstitious beliefs in an invisible God are just ridiculous, right? Because look at his little son. And the school kind of complained to him that, you know, could you rein in your son a little bit? And he wasn't going to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking there, and I'm thinking, and his whole point was, see, that just proves there's no God, because God should respond. You know, and
yeah.
I'm like, well, you're lucky God is a God of grace, right? That
you'd be all gung-ho for your son being struck dead.
Yeah, because he's a God of grace, and what are you doing to your son's mind as he grows to be an adult? What kind of an attitude is he going to have? And the thing is, when he and his son have that attitude, the last people that God's going to, everything else being equal, the last thing that he's going to do is reveal his secrets and intimate things to people who have an attitude like that, aside from, you know, somebody praying and them coming to a change of heart. So there's a sense in which, as the atheist and the person shakes their fist at God and screams at him and mocks him, you know, he's there giving them every breath and every heartbeat and extending enormous patience and grace and love, because, you know, he doesn't want anyone to perish. So anyway, there's this whole issue that you run into with these situations where when you look at history and you see, okay, these Zadok guys got to be closer to God, and then you've got Benjamin and Judah, they got to be close to God, and then the question is, as an individual, do you want to be close to God? And I hope the answer is yes, right? And it just means that the people who obeyed him and were serious about him, he favors. I mean, he it's not like he, you know, he loves all people, but people who are obedient and have a heart for him are the ones that he brings closest, just like Moses, right?
Mm-hmm.
He showed himself to Moses in a way that he didn't show himself to other people. And Jesus, even at the Mount of Transfiguration, right? He had Peter, James, and John.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have all 12 of them there, right? And he's like, these are the ones that are really close. And you see John all the way through his gospel talk about the disciple whom Jesus loved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he's essentially saying that of all the 12 disciples, I had a closer relationship,
mm-hmm.
which sounds like, wow, what a thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, you look at, you know, who was given the book of Revelation?
Mm-hmm.
John. Who was given the book of Daniel in the Old Testament? All those prophecies, Daniel. And look what it says about, it says, oh, Daniel, greatly beloved of the Lord. And you look at the life of Daniel, what do you see with Daniel? You see he's, can you find, I'm not saying he's perfect, but can you find a sin recorded for Daniel
mm-hmm.
anywhere in Scripture? You can't. So there's that whole issue again where, yeah, God loves everyone, but you can be somebody who has a greater heart for God than maybe some other people, right? And so that's part of what pastors sit around trying to figure out is how to motivate people, motivate ourselves first off, and then motivate people that we're involved with to want to be closer to God, to seek after God. So, you know, it's kind of weird to get that all from a geography, but you know, it's there if you look for it. This kind of stuff is all through the Bible in different ways. So any questions or thoughts about this whole land layout thing?
Cubits.
Well, it doesn't say, it's in italics, right?
Oh, right.
25,000 italic
yeah,
cubits.
Right.
So the cubits isn't, when that right there where they put cubits, yeah. they're inferring cubits
yeah.
from what else has been said.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one verse where some translations think it's rods, and the
right.
other has
oh,
cubits.
Right, right.
Right? And a rod being the thing that the angel had, right? It's like
mm-hmm.
a longer pole.
Why did a different number in verse 1?
In which verse?
In verse 1.
Mm-hmm.
We
have 25,000 and 10,000 in line.
And mine's 25,000 and 20,000.
Okay. Yeah. So there again, I bet that's I didn't really look at that, but I'm guessing that that's probably a different in manuscript evidence. The different manuscript families, there's a difference between the 10 versus 20.
But the rest are all 20.
Mm-hmm.
Are all 10.
10.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The other is where it says 25,000 and 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
But just the first verse for some reason.
Huh.
So maybe a type.
Interesting, yeah. So that's the NSV, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't pick up on that. I should have, but I didn't.
Mine says...
Yours is miles, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they translate it for him into miles.
Which makes me a lot easier to read.
Yeah.
To understand.
Yeah,
well, on your map, it showed it in miles, too.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So there's pros and cons to that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you get into situations where... when they translate things, it makes it easier to understand today's measurements, but there's some cases where the underlying figures carry significance,
yeah.
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
having to do with like 6 or something like that.
So it's 8 1/3 miles long and 6 2/3 miles wide.
Right. The strip.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And again, the city itself is,
yeah,
is in the southern section of that. Overall.
And then the sanctuary is 875 by 875
feet.
Within
yeah.
feet.
Yeah.
With 87.5 feet of open space all around it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's definitely, you know, this whole arrangement is definitely different than anything
yeah.
else that's happened. And again, you know, it gets to be when you start to say, well, it's just a spiritual lesson and that's not really going to be real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at these precise
so
dimensions.
Much detail
yeah,
for it to be.
It's like, well, what's the 87 and a half feet mean then?
Mm-hmm.
Right? What's the spiritual lesson from 87 and a half feet? You know. And I didn't dig up some of the commentaries that go that way on this section, but
mm-hmm.
earlier, remember, I've shared some that they're pretty far-fetched, what they try to come up with there. So the other thing that comes out of this is you will talk to Christians frequently in our day that when you talk about... So when you go political with the Bible, right,
mm-hmm.
and you start talking about modern-day Israel, so there are people who kind of have this view that Jesus came in an apolitical way. In other words, he had absolutely no design or idea of having any kind of a banjo. No. Wow.
Time to wake up. Cold. That's Mary's alarm clock.
Yeah.
In case you're napping in the middle of the
night. Yeah.
So, we've talked about this a lot too. But so today, if you take Christians in general, you could kind of divide them somewhat on an interview question where you'd say, "Hello, Mr. Christian. I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you think that the modern state of Israel and the land that they're in has any biblical significance today?"
I certainly do.
Okay, he does. but there are quite a few Christians
yeah.
that would say no.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That
they shouldn't have any land.
Well, that it's just not significant,
right.
that the promised land from the Old Testament has no bearing on actual geographical property today.
Hmm.
And one of the things they would use to say that is that, well, the New Testament doesn't talk about the promised land much. Jesus didn't restate the land promise.
Mm.
And so there's kind of this... And then along with that, they have the view that Jesus, when he came offering the kingdom, it was only spiritual. There's no actual geographical, literal aspect to it. So that the throne of David all through the Old Testament had, you know, a real... guy who sat as a king on a real throne in a real country in the capital of the city, but when we get to Jesus, that's all out the window, and it's just a spiritual kingdom that has no future relevance to geopolitical settings on earth, right? So that would be one camp of
mm-hmm.
Christians, and so that camp is also typically the camp that would not take this passage at face value, because this is talking about land.
Mm-hmm.
And it's talking about a specific area in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And it's talking about tribes and where they're going to camp and physical boundaries. And these physical boundaries are tied to the promised land
mm-hmm.
from the earlier Old Testament. So we go back to the earlier Old Testament, we see all this stuff about Abraham, the place where you walk on your feet,
mm-hmm.
and the place you see, or mm-hmm. Moses, when you go up to the mountain, you can't cross over, but you see over there, that's
mm-hmm.
the land.
Mm-hmm.
That's the land I'm giving to you, kind of thing. And then you get to where we are today, where many Christians feel like, well, the promised land was fulfilled, or it has no relevance today. And then you get to this passage of Scripture which we're saying, well, there's all sorts of things about it that have never happened in history.
Mm-hmm.
And many believers, including myself, think that it's tied into the millennial reign that occurs, a thousand-year reign after Christ's return. And that basically says that this then is kind of a hot potato. So the temple was a hot potato, we saw, because of the book of Hebrews and things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a hot potato, too, because it's talking about land. And it... If it's real and it's literal, it's never happened, and it's future. Well, what does that say then, that the land is still has some significance, or has some future significance,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that again is a view that many Christians aren't comfortable with. They're not comfortable with the idea that the land has any kind of future significance, and that God has still is going to make a distinction between the nation of Israel and the other nations of the world, like the passages we see where it talks about all the nations going up to worship in Jerusalem, right? Mm-hmm. In Zechariah and some of these other passages.
Well, if you read down further, it talks about land, it talks about city, it talks about property, you know, 6, 7, 8.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't got there yet, but...
Right.
I mean, it does start...
West border, east border. Yeah. So when I'd said at one time, I said that when we got to, like, when we were going through the book of Ezekiel, when we get to Ezekiel 40, we get into some hot areas.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't just mean that they're hard to slog through. They are. But I was just talking about this idea that you hit some things here that are controversial,
mm-hmm.
for not just Christians, but politically as well. Because, I mean, mm-hmm. if we're sitting here talking about, well, do Christians today think that the land where Israel is that God is interested in that land, that he considers it my land, as he
mm-hmm.
calls it in
mm-hmm.
the Old Testament, and that he has actually deemed that it's eventually going to be Israel's when they're obedient,
mm-hmm.
right? You are, right away, you're going to divide Christian groups.
Mm-hmm.
And now if you go outside the Christian realm and you start talking about the world politically, what they think about Israel in the land, you've got a whole lot more people
mm-hmm.
that are opposed to Israel being
mm-hmm.
there. And so the fact that we see a temple here, which is a hot potato, and then we see this land is another hot potato. And that's why I keep going back over and over and maybe kind of beating a dead horse, talking about how do we read Scripture? How do we know whether to take it at face value or not? How do we know whether we can spiritualize it or not? And the reason I keep emphasizing and saying, what was the context when it was given and how would the first readers have understood it? I keep saying all those things. And the reason is, it's not just a arbitrary theological discussion like how many angels can be on the head of a man, right? Because these are topics that, if we understand the New Testament correctly, are going to be hotter and hotter political topics,
mm.
right? And so in our own day, we've already seen how much opposition Israel has
mm-hmm.
through the United Nations and through the surrounding countries. And so the issue then is, if we get this wrong, it's a big deal. Because let's say that Israel and the land is not significant to God. I'm all goofed up. Then if we get it wrong and we think it is, number one, we're out of step with God. Number two, we're going to end up putting ourselves in risky situations, either as a country or, for instance, you know, where it talks about, I will bless those who bless you, and I'll curse those who curse you. Okay,
mm-hmm.
there's many Christians that don't think that applies to Israel today, that it just kind of ended a little bit after Abraham.
Hmm.
Okay? So my point is, if Israel's in a place of persecution and pressure, and as a country you step out because you believe they are still blessed, and that God will bless those who bless Israel, you're taking a big, potentially a big political, even possibly military
mm-hmm.
risk, and you're making a mistake
mm-hmm.
if you're wrong. That's a big boo-boo,
mm-hmm.
right? On the other side of it, if God does still think Israel's significant, and he does bless those who bless and curse those who curse still, and he does think the land's significant, and you don't,
mm-hmm.
that's a big boo-boo too.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you're not going to stand with the chosen people. And the other thing is, you're going to be out of step with what God's doing in history
mm-hmm.
as a Christian. And you know what you're going to be like? You're going to be like the tribe of Dan.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be people of God who are ignorant of the will of God and end up opposing the work of God. So you're going to get up every morning, you're going to say, you know, Our Father who is in heaven, hallowed be thy name. You go through the Lord's Prayer, and then you live your life in a way that you're denying something that God's doing in history that he really does care about, if you're out of step with that. And so that's why I'm saying that it's not just an issue about subtleties of, you know, the Trinity or, you know, how did Jesus come to grow in knowledge and stature and that he was God. I mean, those are important questions.
Yeah.
But these aren't abstract issues.
Mm-mm.
They're real issues that are playing out, I believe, are playing out in our world today and have to do with issues that, you know, people have taken risks for in the past. So, that's my blather on that.
Yeah. What I've heard other people say that what we see Israel in now is not all the land that was given to them.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, that's true.
And so, when it all is given to them, there's going to be a bunch of eyes opened up.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be a highly political thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do they, what would they say about the fact that God says that they're going to be scattered among the nations, and then he says in the latter days he's going to bring them back? Like, how can you, the land must be important if he's going to bring them back to the land. And
mm-hmm.
I guess they think that's the church,
right.
Not them.
Right. But like we pointed out, you don't have to gather the church because the church is a global.
Yeah.
Church is global. We're not. We
yeah,
don't
so
have a
particular
land.
Yeah. So what
do
they think? He's going to gather all of us to Israel in the latter days.
Mm-hmm. But like a lot of people, when they read Matthew 24 and Jesus talks about gathering the elect, they're not reading it from an Old Testament context to think that, well, the ones that were scattered, primarily talking about Jews. And it's talking about believing Jew, you know, gathering his elect. I mean, we're his elect too, but we don't need to be gathered. You know, we're to go into all the world,
yeah.
Preach the gospel, and we minister wherever we're saved. We're not called to be there particularly, right? So I would agree with you, but you know, when you start reading the comments by these people who are listening to their teachings, it's pretty ingenious the different ways they have of kind of interpreting things. In a different way. And I think you're blessed because you're reading it at face value. And that's one of the things that's encouraging to me as a teacher is many of what I would say are errors in interpretation don't come from a natural reading of the passage. And so you have to fight uphill to get to that interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And so the beauty is that a simple person who reads the Bible on their own is more likely to come to the understanding that's meant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the Bible's never been entrusted to seminaries and, you know, academics. Not that there aren't academics who are faithful, but I'm just saying that it's delivered to the average person who has a heart for God. And every person who has a heart for God is going to read, you know, in Revelation 7 where it says 12,000 from this tribe, 12,000 from that tribe, they're going to go, well, that means 12,000 from this tribe and 12,000 from that tribe. So, you know, even gets back to one of the ones I always bring up and flop out on the table every time this comes up is in Luke 20 or 21. I can't remember which right off the bat. I should know which. But Jesus says that the Jews will be led captive into all nations until the times of the Gentiles
mm-hmm.
come to an end. And so Jesus himself is saying after the destruction of Jerusalem, after his crucifixion, that the Jews are going to be dispersed until. Well, that until means that they're going to be gathered, right? Like, you're going to be wet until means you're going to be dry at some point. So when he says they're going to be dispersed until, he's saying their dispersal is going to be reversed. They're going to be gathered. And he calls it the times of the Gentiles. Well, Jesus is saying there's a Jewish-Gentile distinction, right? And so many Christians kind of have this idea that once Jesus came, there's nothing Jewish or Israel-oriented about anything God's doing anymore. And so then I would challenge him to say, well, why does he call that the time of the Gentiles? What does he mean? If he doesn't mean that it has a non-Jewish flavor during some period of time and then if there's an until there, at the end of that until, there's a Jewish flavor, right? So you have to be careful about these things, because you can end up kind of denying your Lord, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Jesus says to Jerusalem, you won't see me again until, then there's a time when they are going to see him, when they say this certain thing. And he's speaking to Jerusalem. Well, who was in Jerusalem at the time? Jews. Why Jerusalem? He didn't say it to New York. Didn't say it to London. Didn't say it to Rome. Rome was there at the time. He could have said it to Rome. He didn't. He said it to Jerusalem. So that's where we, it's easy for us to study the Bible and look at Samson, or look at the tribe of Dan, or look at Saul, King Saul, and say, oh, look how they blew it. Mm-hmm. And then we go off with understandings and attitudes. We're doing the exact same thing, because we're denying things that God says he's going to do, because they don't fit our political whims or whatever the reasons are. And then we end up jumping in the shoes of the tribe of Dan individually, right? Whether it's doing idolatrous things in your house, or how you view Israel in general, or all these different things. Yeah, you understand?
I said it goes back to faith. Read it for face value. You have to take it by faith that it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter what you see; it's going to happen. It's a whole thing that plays out, and that's what God rewards: faith. Faith in what he says will happen.
Mm-hmm. So any comments about this whole business of the land showing up again? So who wants to try 6 through 8?
I'll give it a go.
Okay.
You shall appoint as the property of the city an area 5,000 cubits wide and 25,000 cubits long, adjacent to the district of the holy section. It shall belong to the whole house of Israel. The prince shall have a section on one side and the other side of the holy district, and the city's property, and bordering on the holy district and the city's property, extending westward on the west side and eastward on the east side. The length shall be side by side with one of the tribal portions, from the west border to the east border. The land shall be his possession in Israel, and my prince shall no more oppress my people, but they shall give the rest of the land to the house of Israel according to their tribes.
Okay. So this gets at that strip that's on each side of the square.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, there's a strip that goes all the way across.
Right.
So outside of the square part on each side was the land owned by the prince. And I think, as Mary pointed out a couple times back, I think that there is a particular individual who's in this role of the prince, but over time there's going to probably be different ones. Mm-hmm. Be like the king, right? Not a particular king, but per se, the whole time. It's just whoever is in that role, this is their land. And part of what, he keeps underscoring, we've seen this idea that, so this prophecy of Ezekiel is given in the context of Israel being in captivity in Babylon, remember, because of disobedience. And one of the reasons they're in disobedience, if we were to go back and look at what the prophets were saying, especially prophets like Jeremiah and Ezekiel too, but they were targeting the leaders of Israel. You're oppressing the people. You're taking bribes. You're not standing up for the widow. You're not standing up for the fatherless. And so God is saying, justice is what I want to see. If you love me and you want to serve me and you really care about me, then you will execute justice. You know, you won't favor the poor, you won't favor the rich, you will execute justice. And so the lack of justice in Israel, along with idolatry, but, you know, sometimes we get so focused on the idolatrous part because it's pretty important, we kind of lose sight of the fact that God's not just interested in, for lack of a better word, spiritual or religious behavior, right? Because when you focus on idolatry, the tendency there is to think of, you know, false gods, not paying attention to God, paying attention to other things that are not God, and there's a spiritual emphasis to that. But when you get down to this issue of justice, we're talking things like paying your bills, paying your taxes, right? Practical issues that have to do with how government runs, and in particular, he's really interested in these princes, the people who are the leaders of the land. And when you really get back to when he kicks Israel out and takes them up to Babylon, and he basically puts an end to the rule on the throne of David, the reason he puts an end to that throne of David is that throne of David is supposed to be God's representative rule of justice. In the same way that Adam was to be God's ruler, have dominion over the earth, the king on the throne of David was supposed to be reflecting God's ideas about how justice was to be meted out and rule was supposed to occur. And so as those kings were bad and worse and worser and worser, as it went downhill, that's the focus where God finally says, and we could go to some passages where he says, he's speaking to the king and the queen mother, and he's saying, take off your crown. You know, he's focusing on the leaders. He's saying, look, you know, your rule is something that I care about, justice, and you're not giving me justice. And so he finally kicks them off the throne by taking them away to Babylon. And so when he says in here, my princes shall no more oppress my people, in this passage, right, he's talking about this pattern that human leaders in the past have abused their power. And what do they say? Power corrupts, and ultimate power ultimately corrupts, or something. I'm not quoting that right. It's much more clever the way it's said than I just said it. But it's this idea that
something about absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
It's part of it.
And so these kings have more responsibility, and so he's sitting here, God's speaking through Ezekiel, and he's giving this picture of the millennial kingdom, and he's saying this kind of stuff not going to happen there. But he's emphasizing in the context of this huge disobedience where they just got judged because it was going on. So there's this contrast we keep seeing in this passage where he says, you know, my princes shall no more do this. And he's trying to say, look, this is what was going on up until I left that temple, and when I come back, it's going to be different. And that's part of why he's saying he's blocking off that east gate, is he's saying this kind of stuff's not going to happen. And so, you know, we haven't got to verse 9, but he's going to say, enough, princes of Israel, remove violence and plundering, execute justice and righteousness, stop dispossessing my people. And then, he gets to verse 10, I'm kind of reading him, I guess, you shall have honest scales, an honest ephah, and an honest bath. These are measures of economic, volume and weight and all that. And he's talking about things like stock markets and IRAs and money, bank accounts, you know. And so this is one of those things, again, where you look at this and you go, God doesn't, he doesn't have this pigeonholed, narrow view of perfection and what he wants of rightness. His view is like, it covers everything. It covers money. It covers what we do in church. It covers religious leaders. It covers political leaders. It's spiritual and it's material. It's the whole ball of wax. And you know, the world is constantly trying to tweak with that, because you got the situation where in the political realm people want to push off moral issues and issues having to do with God into the religious sphere. You know, that's the religious leader's responsibility, right? And so there's this aspect of separation of church and state, and that's a big complicated thing, but what I'm trying to say in general is that there's, you know, even in families where the father figure in the house would say, well, the religious upbringing of my kids, that's the church's business, right? I mean, the church should be involved. But what we see when we look in the Word of God is he doesn't make that bifurcated kind of thing where he says, you know, religion is this sphere, and then economics and reality and material stuff this sphere, and they're kind of separate. He doesn't do that. He says, Dad, you're the priest of your family, and he says, leaders, I expect you in your day to day pragmatic, you know, Congress, stuff like that, I expect you to be godly. I expect you to walk in godly ways in those situations and quit trying to separate them to where you can behave one way all week and then show up in church for a few hours on Sunday and then you can be the godly person, right? I mean, we all know that, but you see it all the time, because what you see all the time is you see political rulers who... you know, I don't want to be political, but I'm going to go ahead and say this because this is so true. Trump is a great example. Okay, you can't say Trump is a godly man. If you look at history, the things he says about women, the things he's done, you can't say he's a godly man. But he hobnobs with religious leaders to gain religious weight and the appearance that he's a godly man. And so that's the kind of thing I'm talking about here, where you have a leader who, and I'm not saying I'm against him or anything like that. I think a lot of his policies, I think, are way closer to what we want as a country than the alternatives, so don't get me wrong there. But I'm just saying that there's this long thing, whether it's Clinton and his stuff with Monica Lewinsky and then hobnobbing with church stuff, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's this whole situation where you get these leaders. And they want to be around Billy Graham. They want to call the holy man to the prayer breakfast. Mm-hmm. Well, ditch the holy man. Why don't you lead the prayer breakfast?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Of course, then the country would have a big fit because the guy says something about Jesus or whatever. Mm-hmm. Right? But the whole thing, when you look at this, the whole emphasis that God has is he doesn't want to see this business where everyone knows that politics has to be lean and dirty, and then we go play religious stuff. That's not what God wants, and so he doesn't want these religious leaders detached from the practical material world, and he doesn't want the political leaders thinking that they don't have a moral responsibility and a religious spiritual responsibility. And so that's part of what you're seeing in this whole thing is. He's trying to get back at saying, look, you know, this is not just a matter of, you know, love your neighbor is having honest scales.
Yeah, it just, this is a little bit off topic, not that much, but I read an article this morning about one of Benny Hinn's nephews, yeah, Benny Hinn's brother's kid, who had been involved in the ministry of flying on Lear's private jets all over the world and staying at just lavish hotels, and finally how he just came to see that it isn't lining up with scripture, and it was very interesting. He met a girl who was just a little more straight up biblically, and he ended up just walking away from all that, and it was encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, talk about someone flees from an outward appearance, seems to not have the spiritual life lined up,
mm-hmm.
you know, with justice, because he's fleecing people, it seems, you know. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, I guess I got a little carried away there, but that happens sometimes.
Yeah.
Since I read 9 and 10, you know, basically what he's saying there is he wants practical godliness in how things are run day to day on the ground. You know, and this is part of the whole balance that you have to kind of walk as a Christian, because there are Christians that want to teach us that God's number one priority is social justice.
Yeah.
The number one priority is social justice. Well, God is interested in social justice. But our job as the church is not, our number one priority is not social justice. Our number mm-hmm. one priority is redemption.
Mm-hmm.
Preaching the gospel to those who will come to believe in Christ. And through them coming to faith and believing in God, lives are transformed and you get social justice. Right? So you don't want to get the cart before the horse, but he does care about social justice enormously, and so we don't want to forget that either in how we, you know, live our lives. Because I mean, if you look at this, it's all, you know, it's all measurements and stuff. Honest scales, ephah, honest bath. An ephah and a bath shall be the same measure. The bath contains one tenth of a homer, and the ephah one tenth of a homer. The measure shall be according to the homer, right? I mean, you know, he's talking about calibration of commercial measures. So it's kind of interesting to see that he's that focused on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and today, if you, you know, I'm not privy to what goes on in the financial world, but I'm also not naive enough to think that there's not a lot of shenanigans going on
mm-hmm.
in the financial world
yeah.
with all sorts of different sorts of playing with things in ways that aren't straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what he's saying in this passage. I mean, if you wanted to step back and do like a really high view translation, he's saying, don't mess around,
right.
Be straightforward.
Didn't really Christ do the same thing when he cleansed the temple? It was social justice. They were cheating people within. They were making a market out of it, but they were cheating the people. And of course, it was supposed to be a house of prayer. But he was really angered him because they took it away from the out of a house of prayer and started cheating the people. And that's when he drove them out. Which I.
Mm-hmm. Well, we only have a couple more minutes. So any comments about anything we've talked about tonight?
We need a chart for all of these.
Huh?
We need a chart for all of these terms and how they all stack up.
Oh. Yeah, you want some homework? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think you have the resources.
I do?
Much more.
Oh.
Yeah, it's always,
you have the resource.
Yeah.
It's called a Bible Dictionary. It's the same resource I would go to.
So you don't know of any particular...
I don't have all the ephahs and omers and everything on the tip of my... Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah.
Not,
even my calculator doesn't button. Have those conversions.
Mike's got one.
Yeah, see? Study Bible. That's all you need.
Bible. Yes.
King
James. Yeah, I know, but
study Bible. It's a dry measure equivalent to a bushel. 6 ephah.
Imperial gallon.
Yeah.
Probably all the study Bibles
get their little...
Yeah, somewhere they'll...
How much is a bushel?
A bushel?
Yeah.
Yeah, then we have to figure out how much a bushel is.
A bushel and a pack?
And make my
hug around the neck.
Is that a song?
I love you, a bushel and a pack.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah.
Actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you know the thing about the Bible too is when we read cubit and ephahs and shekels, you tend to like glaze over,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's like if you go on some forums on the internet with people who are skeptical about the Bible, they often like to take, especially the King James. They like to take passages and mock them because
mm-hmm.
they're just so old-fashioned, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the thing about it is what we're reading here is 2,500 years old,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you were to take a novel by some author from 2,500 years ago, it would read just as foreign,
mm-hmm.
right? And so there's a sense in which when people make fun of the thou shalt and the mm-hmm. thou this and thy and thee and all that, you know, they're really not really seeing it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really understanding that really what you're mocking is an amazing thing, because here's this writing from 2,500 years ago, or this particular book, and it's still relevant and people are still studying it today.
Mm-hmm.
Find a comic book like that, or find some other thing that you like that reads modernly the way you like, and then try looking at it. And so that's the challenge that we have too as Christians, as we read these passages, especially these ones like from Leviticus and Deuteronomy and everything.
I have a question though. Uh-huh. Christ is going to be ruling and reigning from this point here.
Mm-hmm.
Is that my next thinking? Is shekels and Omer's? Is that going to be how the world will be? And that's what the
measurements
would be. I'm just guessing, because it would be it would be equal. Because you start getting into calendars like this, there's differences.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be it could be worldwide, and everybody's on the same page.
Mm-hmm. We're all going to be speaking Hebrew.
Well, you understand what I'm saying.
Right.
It's a different world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A standard of measure, a mm-hmm. worldwide standard of measure. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.